A reality check at the Pentagon, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Rosa Brooks grew up the daughter of anti-war demonstrators. Then she ended up working at the Pentagon after 9/11.
Whoa. You know, on some level, I should have known this already, but you go to work at the Pentagon, and whether, even if you're not the one who pulls any triggers ever or gives any orders, you know, you're part of a vast bureaucratic enterprise that reaches down out of the sky and kills people thousands of miles away.
Plus, what are those dark red circles on Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps's shoulder?
It's not like a welt. It's not raised. You know, skin is level, but it's a purplish hue. It's kind of like a bruise. A lot of the members of the team kind of swear by it as one of their recovery methods.
The ancient treatment known as cupping, explained ahead on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're tuned to The World. Remember when refugees were arriving in Greece by boat from Turkey, hundreds, even thousands every day? Well, we have an update now on that situation, and it's not good. Back in March, Turkey and the European Union struck a deal to reduce the refugee flow. Today, the New York-based Women's Refugee Commission sounded an alarm over the agreement's impact on refugees. The advocacy group says the deal forced Greece to shift from being a transit country to being a host country, with terrible consequences for the refugees. The WRC calls it a humanitarian and protection disaster, especially for women and girls. Reporter Jean Carstensen is currently on the Greek island of Lesbos. She spent the past several weeks traveling to refugee camps in northern Greece.
They're scattered all around Thessaloniki and the northern region of Greece. They're just big tent camps. Some of them are inside warehouses. Some of them are in outside fields. The food is marginal. The hygiene situation is very bad. You know, thousands of people are sharing 40 or 50 outdoor porta potties. There's not a lot of privacy in the showers. They're really very rough, crude camps for the most part.
So part of the deal was Greece was going to get financial support from the EU to look after people. What's happened to that money, or what's happened to those services?
Well, a lot of the money goes through the UNHCR and other NGOs. I think it's a complicated formula that they've come up with to distribute these funds. But it's clear that wherever that money is, not enough of it is getting into the actual camps to improve these facilities, because there's just no way that people can live in these camps for very much longer. You know, since February, March, when the borders started closing and then they finally closed, a lot of people got stuck here, up to 57,000, and then they got redistributed into these camps that were put up very quickly, and they're just not meant for long-term occupation.
What kinds of stories are you hearing from the women in these places?
I talk to a lot of women, of course, and they feel extra vulnerable. I've had people tell me they're too scared to go to the bathroom at night because they have to cross through an area that's unsafe. I've had women tell me, you know, they're harassed. Some of this is by other ethnic groups. There might be Afghans harassing Syrians or the other way around. But it's not always that. It's just the situation of women being very, very vulnerable. You know, these camps at night, there's not a lot of security there. That means if something happens, a fight breaks out, women are getting harassed, there's not really anybody there to deal with that.
So something has to give. Something has to change. What do you see unfolding in the next days, weeks, months?
Well, the conditions need to improve here. I don't see any signs, however, that they are going to. Things are really reaching a boiling point for this population. One new trend that we're seeing is some people are giving up and going back to Turkey and Syria. They might do so illegally, going back across the border in the north. And I talk to many people who say they know people who've already done it, and then they say, we're waiting a month or two. And if nothing happens for us in, say, 2 months, we will consider going back. So at least from what I've heard from refugees I spoke to recently, something like 1 or 2 months. And then I don't know what people are going to do if conditions don't improve.
Is there anything that gives you hope? Has anything changed for the better? Do you carry an image with you from the camps that allows you to think things could get better?
When I go actually to the camps right now, it is a little bit hard to be optimistic because it's August, it's very hot, conditions are bad, and most people I meet are really not very happy. I guess there are people that have gotten access to the relocation program. One family of Yazidis that I've become somewhat close to, I know they've been accepted by France. They're just waiting for the final thumbs up, and that means a family of nine will move on to France, and I see their thrill about that. But mostly what I see is people who aren't getting answers and access and a lot of frustration right now.
Well, we're really glad that you're staying on the story. That's Jean Carstensen from Lesbos in Greece, covering the refugee crisis in Europe. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeb.
Jean's reporting is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. As we heard a couple minutes ago, many of the refugees in Greece are fleeing the war in Syria, and that conflict saw a dramatic turnaround this weekend. Rebel forces managed to surprise many by launching a large-scale coordinated attack in and around the ancient city of Aleppo. For the past 3 weeks, the rebel-held area of Aleppo had been under intense siege from the forces of President Bashar al-Assad. Most observers expected the city to fall, but the rebels have been able to break open the government's blockade. And not only that, now the government-held part of the city is under threat. One opposition leader called it a miracle. The World's Richard Hall is covering events from Beirut in neighboring Lebanon. He says even the location of the attack was a surprise.
It was actually a joint operation on the southwest. Many people were expecting the rebels to retake the road that they lost, which was kind of going out of the northwest direction. But they took fighters from Idlib province, which is to the west, and came around underneath and fought in from the southwest and opened up a new corridor going in. And over the course of Saturday, fighting was ongoing. They finally broke through, and you had rebels from both sides, from the besieged eastern Aleppo and the people fighting from the west, meeting up in the middle.
How did they pull it off?
So what we're seeing in Aleppo now is the result of a joint operation by a coalition of rebel groups. And at the very front of these groups is a group called Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, which until very recently was called Jabhat al-Nusra. This is the offshoot of al-Qaeda. And what happened over the past couple of weeks was that Jabhat Fateh al-Sham broke away from al-Qaeda in order to foster better ties with other rebel groups in Aleppo and northern Syria. And what we're seeing now as a result of that breaking away is a closer cooperation between all the rebel groups fighting in northern Syria. That has made their operations much more effective.
It seemed as if it was over in Aleppo, though. So this is a huge turnaround. And I can understand if the rebels are coordinating better and unifying better, that would make a difference. But what else has shifted? Who seems to be running the show?
Well, the big shift now is that jihadist groups are essentially running the show. What we've seen over the past few days is the former al-Qaeda-linked rebel group essentially leading an operation to free a besieged population in Aleppo. And what this means is that they're going to gain huge public support in these areas. This is a group that many Syrians were suspicious of before. They didn't like their extremism. It was alien to most Syrians. But situations like this, where they can come in and they can really play the rescuer, really helps them in terms of gaining support among Syrians.
And just to be clear, as we're trying to understand and sort out these groups, this rebel action has nothing to do with ISIS, right?
No, this is completely separate from ISIS. ISIS is operating in another part of the country, further east and further north.
So big turnaround, but no sense yet whether it's definitive.
Yeah, it remains to be seen what's going to happen over the next few days. I mean, this was really a battle the rebels had to win. If they lost eastern Aleppo, if they lost their foothold in Aleppo, their whole base of operations in northern Syria would have been under threat. They would have been fractured and fragmented all across northern Syria. But for Bashar al-Assad, this is a tremendous defeat as well. This was supposed to be wrapping up almost of the Aleppo battle. It's supposed to be the government regaining control of the larger city, but the rebels have kind of changed the narrative a bit by breaking this siege.
Rich, we're talking about all these dynamics, but we shouldn't forget that there's tremendous suffering going on in Aleppo right now. Any thoughts about that situation for civilians, the humanitarian situation?
That's right. On both sides now, there's terrible suffering. We're hearing reports in western Aleppo now, even though the siege isn't in place yet, that food prices are going up, fuel prices are going up. So the fear of a siege is already kicking in western Aleppo. In eastern Aleppo, the situation is desperate. They haven't been able to deliver significant amounts of food yet, and they've been under siege since early July. So the situation for civilians on both sides is really terrible when all this fighting is going on.
The World's Richard Hall in Beirut. Thank you for the update.
Thank you very much.
Baseball is a sport full of characters, and we're going to talk about one of them right now. Ichiro Suzuki, the first Japanese position player to play in the major leagues here in the U.S. He recently reached a huge milestone, 3,000 hits. It's a big deal. But what's more interesting is how Suzuki does what he does. ESPN staff writer Tommy Tomlinson wrote about Ichiro Suzuki's distinct process. Tommy, just what sets him apart?
Well, I think the first thing that people notice is all his little quirks and details, little things that he's perfected over the years to get him ready to hit. He has a very distinctive batting stance. He holds his bat out, you know, almost like he's a fencer or something. Like, he holds his bat straight out in front of him, sort of pointed to the sky like a sword almost. And he reaches around and tugs on his sleeve that's facing the pitcher, almost like an archer getting ready to draw a bow. And so that batting stance is something that's unique in baseball history. Nobody else looks like that. But then there's a lot of stuff sort of behind the scenes that most fans don't see that people inside baseball know as being even more meticulous in his routine. The way he prepares to hit, he has special exercises that he does on special machines that he had imported from Japan just for him. I watched him a couple of times before the game, just preparing the locker room, and he would do things like clean his own cleats with a wire brush, which most players don't do. They get clubhouse guys to do that. He would take his jersey out and get a little pair of sewing scissors and clip the straight threads off the jersey.
That's amazing.
I know. And then when he was done, he would take a lint roller and clean the carpet in front of his locker. So it's just sort of like, I said something about it being kind of the intersection of zen and obsession and preparation, which I think makes him unique among baseball players and legendary among fans and other players for the preparation he puts into the game.
And is it true that he pampers his bats sort of like a violinist would their instrument?
He does. He has a special case for them. That's climate controlled. He thinks that humidity is bad for bats. So the moisture makes them not hit as well. A dry bat, in his mind at least, is a better bat. So he has a little case next to his locker that he keeps them in, and he takes his case on the road with him. And he's convinced a couple of other players of that. So a couple of his teammates on the Marlins and a couple of teammates that he's had on other teams over the years have picked up this same habit from him is doing that. And he also, you know, there's a legendary story of him that he threw a bat or something during a game at one point, and he was so upset with himself for doing this that he took the bat to his hotel room sort of as a form of apology to the bat to say, I shouldn't have treated you this way. He treats his equipment very reverently and thinks of his bats and gloves and all those things as being almost sort of sentient beings that need to be cared for and paid attention to.
Ichiro is 42. He says he wants to play baseball until he's 50. Is that possible?
So I think it's possible for him to play several more years. 50 is a stretch, I would say, but if anybody could do it, he's the guy.
I was going to say, if anybody could do it. ESPN staff writer Tommy Tomlinson, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
A former Pentagon official reflects on the changing nature of war in the age of drone strikes. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're tuned to The World. This September marks the 15th anniversary of 9/11. It's hard to take in just how much our world has changed since then. But Rosa Brooks is here to help. She's a Georgetown University law professor and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Brooks grew up going to anti-war demonstrations, but later ended up working at the Pentagon. We spoke recently about her new book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. I started by asking her where she was on September 11th, 2001.
I was living in the
a very small town called Free Union, Virginia, which is about 10 miles outside of Charlottesville. And I was teaching at the University of Virginia Law School and was driving in to work on a little country road listening to NPR on the radio when I heard the first news of a plane flying into the World Trade Center.
And do you remember kind of how you understood the attacks, what you thought of the initial U.S. response?
You know, I remember getting into work, and within half an hour, the University of Virginia had canceled all classes, and people started just going home. No one quite knew what to do. But I ended up going out to lunch with a couple of colleagues and sort of looking at each other and saying, everything is going to be different now.
And less than a decade later, there you are working in the Pentagon, somewhere you never expected to be, as a senior advisor to Undersecretary of Defense Michelle Flournoy. The subtitle of your book is Tales from the Pentagon. And you open the book with this pretty powerful anecdote that's very post-9/11 about a briefing on an impending drone strike. Can you take us back to that moment, too, and how that affected you?
Yeah, and this was in, I think, late in 2010, and it was before U.S. drone strikes had become a big media issue at all. And they really weren't, I think, registering in a particularly big way, either in the public mind or in my own. And I found myself sitting in this room, one of those Pentagon classified conference rooms with no windows, and you feel like you're in an airlock deeply underwater or something. And we were being shown a set of slides about a young man, the suspected terrorist, and these are amazingly detailed. You know, we had his picture, we had his resume, we had details about his suspected terrorist strikes he'd been involved in, and everybody's kind of sitting there looking serious and looking grave, and the briefers were saying, well, we haven't been able to strike him because he's been in populated areas, but as soon as a window of opportunity opens up, as soon as he's no longer near other people, we're going to strike using an unmanned aerial vehicle to minimize risk to our people. And I sort of sat there thinking, you know, you know, it felt very routine. It's all very bureaucratic. It didn't feel different from any other meeting. And a couple of days later, I was eating dinner with my children, who were, I think, maybe 4 and 7 at the time, eating spaghetti and meatballs. And my cell phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was one of my colleagues. And he had been at that meeting with me, and he said, hey, you know that window of opportunity we were talking about? It just opened up. And I knew immediately what he meant, that the strike that had been planned had actually occurred, and this guy whose picture I'd been looking at and whose resume I'd been looking at was now dead. And I said, okay, thanks for letting me know. We'll talk tomorrow. We obviously couldn't talk any more about it on the phone. And I still didn't think that much of it. You know, I went back to having dinner with my kids, and then that night I had a terrible nightmare, I still scares me to think of it. It was just this awful nightmare of someone I loved murdered and body parts all over. And I kind of woke up shaking, and it, you know, it sort of hit me only then. Whoa, you know, on some level, I should have known this already. But you go to work at the Pentagon, and whether even if you're not the one who pulls any triggers ever or gives any orders, you know, you're part of a vast bureaucratic enterprise that kills people, that reaches down out of the sky and kills people thousands of miles away.
Wow. It makes me think of the stories we have heard a lot since then of drone operators actually being in their regular lives in the U.S., but going to work and working on these drone strikes, and the sort of dissonance of that, of kind of regular life and a battlefield far away.
Yeah.
And all of that is part of what the book is really about, right? That in some way there's the moral issues that were snagging your mind, as it were, but also your realization of how war has changed.
That's right. And the issues that are raised are really unfamiliar to us. And, you know, when I think about things like drone strikes, targeted killing seems a little chilling. I sometimes say to my friends who are critical, well, would you prefer untargeted killings? Because that's what the United States and the Allies did during World War II. For instance, we, you know, carpet bombed entire cities. That's not better, obviously, than a strike which is able to single out a single individual rather than indiscriminately killing thousands upon thousands of people. But at the same time, it does start blurring the boundaries of what we think of war, because we think of war as you're killing the enemy not because you know anything about him as an individual. You're killing him just because he's the enemy, period. Whereas with the technologies that we now have today, the combination of precision targeting technologies and intelligence and surveillance technologies, we really are targeting specified individuals. And it starts, morally speaking, it feels very uncomfortable because it starts feeling a whole lot more like assassinations and a whole lot more like murder.
Would you say that after years of criticism and some changes, particularly by the Obama administration, that the protections have gotten better? In other words, is the U.S. using drone strikes in a more responsible, ethical, legal way?
Yes and no. I think that when the Obama administration says they work very, very hard to minimize or ideally prevent altogether civilian casualties, that is absolutely true. But what I think is still extremely troubling and really I think is inexcusable is the level of secrecy and the lack of any non-executive branch, meaningful non-executive branch oversight. We still have a situation where, in essence, the U.S. is saying we can kill any person anywhere on Earth at any time based on evidence that we will not share with anybody else. It will be a secret, and we will never even acknowledge who we killed. I find that shocking.
You know, we started out talking about 9/11, and you write that you were pregnant that day driving to work when you first heard. I was pregnant as well at that time, and I think of that crop of kids as 9/11 babies. They've sort of grown up and been incubated in this new atmosphere. Do you feel like you can put your finger on what's different for them because of this endless war footing that we find ourselves in?
Yeah. You know, they in some ways take for granted a world that those of us old enough to be working in government, to be senior journalists and so on, I think still struggle with. You know, they take for granted a world in which the dividing line between war and peace is fuzzy.
Yeah, that's really interesting and sobering. Rosa Brooks is the author of the new book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. She's a law professor at Georgetown and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Thank you for talking to us about all this.
Thank you.
News headlines are coming right up here on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Ahead, we meet singer-songwriter Nima Samimi.
So I'm an American-born, mixed-heritage Iranian-American. My mother's French-Canadian, my father's Iranian.
And he sings Americana music inspired by Sufi poetry.
What really is strong inside of me is this sense of abstract inspiration.
That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Russia's reputation as a global sports power took another huge hit over the weekend. Organizers for the Paralympic Games in Rio banned the entire Russian team from competing. That's in addition to Russian athletes being banned from all track and field Olympic events, and a long list of other Russian athletes who are banned from other Olympic disciplines as well. All because of a massive doping scandal that's decimated Russia's delegation to the 2016 Games. But there are still Russians competing in Rio, and we wondered if the fans back home are still cheering them on despite all the controversy. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. How would you describe Russian interest in the Games?
Well, they are interested. Certainly, there's been a lot of coverage. Russia has, in the last year, it launched a state-sponsored version of ESPN. It's called Match TV, and they have round-the-clock coverage of the Russian team in Rio, and there's been a lot of focus on their successes so far. They've got one gold, two silvers, three bronzes now as of today. The gold medal winner, in fact, is this Beslan Mudranov, who's from the Caucasus region of Kabardino-Balkaria, won the gold in his judo weight class. And, you know, I suppose everyone loves a winner. But I have to say that the send-off for the Russian team to Rio was blackluster for the Russian squad. They have a sort of traditional, you know, send-off at the airport with music and things like that. The participation wasn't very heavy, and the sense was that ultimately, you know, all these scandals have kind of taken its toll on the enthusiasm for the Russian presence in Rio.
Do people there believe the allegations of systematic doping and official cover-up?
They don't, by and large, I would say. For example, there was a poll recently conducted that 71% of Russians doubt the authorities were ever involved in a doping cover-up. So the idea of a state-sponsored system just doesn't ring true to Russians. Some of the allegations, even to most of the rest of us, sound so fantastic, it's kind of hard to wrap our minds around it. It's also worth noting that the prime source of all these allegations is the former head of the Russian anti-doping agency here, who's now in the United States. That's brought up quite a bit. Grigory Ravchenko is now in the U.S., cooperating with U.S. authorities as well as other world governing sport body authorities. And, you know, the sense is that this is something that's just is too fantastic to be true.
What's been the reaction then if they don't believe it?
Well, they're angry, but the sense is that it's politics invading its way into sport, that somehow Russia's being punished for its assertive foreign policy. And by that, I mean what it's doing in Crimea with the annexation of Crimea, or perhaps for its support of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And that somehow this is all kind of payback on that front.
So now this new ban, the Paralympics, presumably just adds insult to injury.
It does. And, you know, there was a press conference here in Moscow today with the Paralympic Committee expressing essentially their view on all this. They've said this is, and it really sounds very similar to the arguments we've heard from the Russians all along concerning the calls for an Olympic ban, that this is collective punishment, that it violates athletes' human rights. They stopped short of saying this decision was political, but keep in mind that, you know, under Putin, Russia has seen both its Olympic and Paralympic squads achieve these sort of phenomenal results. So even if we just take the Paralympics alone, they not only topped the medal count in Sochi, they dominated. Russian Paralympians scored 65 more medals than the nearest competitor. And at the time, you know, that was seen as a real achievement, not in the sense only in the sense of sport, but in terms of progress for disabled rights in Russia. It was the first time, you know, you'd seen this kind of attention given to the rights and dreams of Russian Paralympic athletes. And now, of course, that's all being put under the microscope internationally. As of this moment, anyway, over 250 Russian Paralympians are banned from participating in the Games.
And meanwhile, we've got this kind of sad, toxic atmosphere in Rio. Yesterday, a Russian swimmer who was implicated in the doping scandal was booed. What's it like to watch that from there, and how are Russians taking it?
You know, essentially, the Russians coming into this knew they had a lot to prove. They have an annual send-off at the Kremlin. Vladimir Putin sort of greets the Russian Olympic squad. And this year, he said, you know, the whole country is rooting for you, but the rest of the world is against you. And go prove yourselves. That's essentially been kind of the attitude going forward, even with this Russian swimmer. One of the Russian swimmers, Yulia Efimova, who you mentioned, was booed upon taking part in her swim meet yesterday. You know, she came out of this and gave an interview to state television, said this has just made her madder. She's going to compete even harder. So I think Russians have basically taken just this whole thing with a chip on their shoulder and with the idea that they have something to prove. So I think what we're going to see is new names kind of crop up among Russians of people to cheer on, because the people that the sponsors had gotten behind, the people that they were looking forward to seeing competing in Rio, they're not there.
They'll find their heroes.
They'll find them.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
If you've been watching the Olympics, you've probably seen them. Big purple circles on swimmer Michael Phelps and on members of the USA men's gymnastics team. Those circles are the result of an ancient treatment called cupping, and some Olympic athletes swear by it. Rachel Axon is in Rio covering the Olympics for USA Today. Rachel, there's been a lot of buzz about this, people noticing the purple marks. They look almost like welts or lesions or bruises. Mm-hmm. When did you first see them, and when did you first know about cupping?
Throughout the past couple years, mostly this year, I would say, you know, you tend to see, especially their shoulders. It's less like a welt. The skin's not like raised. It's not like swollen, but it's like a purplish color. It almost looks like a bruise. A lot of the members of the team kind of swear by it as one of their recovery methods.
And what is the cupping method exactly? How does it work?
So there's a couple different ways. Kind of the traditional way would be to use a swab with alcohol or some other flammable liquid on it and kind of coat the inside of a glass cup, light that on fire, and then when the flame goes out, put that on. Typically, it would be like your back, your shoulders. And then as it cools down, that creates a suction and pulls the skin up. A more cheaper, easier way to do it is some of the men's gymnastics athletes do this. You can buy on Amazon for like $15 these little plastic cups. There's a hand pump that suctions the air out and pulls that up. So if anyone's seen, there's an Under Armour commercial that Michael Phelps did about kind of this being his last hurrah. And there's a clip in there of him having it done. And he had it done kind of the more traditional way. A lot of the men's gymnasts are kind of taking the DIY approach.
And where did the method originate?
It's a little bit disputed, but it's China or Egypt. I mean, this goes back, you know, many, many hundreds of years. So it depends on where you read, but it's either or both of those.
And what does it actually do? What's the benefit?
What the gymnasts will tell you is, you know, a lot of them get massaged to, you know, they do a lot of hard training and kind of working out issues in their muscles. They think cupping makes a difference is because it pulls things up instead of pushing them down. It kind of releases, you know, maybe some of the lactic acid, loosens, you know, the muscles and ligaments. That's kind of the reasoning behind it. There's a gymnast, Alex Nador, who he's a great story. He made the team this year after being an alternate in London. And, you know, he's not old by any stretch of the imagination, but he is 25. And that's a little bit up there. Not too bad for the men, but he's not a college guy anymore. And he said cupping has literally probably saved his career at this point because he's relied on it so much this season.
And when he says that, he actually attributes his performance to it?
To a degree, yes. I mean, part of what is the life of an athlete is you have your training, but what you're doing between training, I mean, everything you do goes into it, how much you're sleeping, what you're eating, and your recovery method. And some of the women really like dry needling. Some of them swear by massage. You know, a lot of them use Normatec, which is like a ice compression. You'll see them sometimes and their whole legs are in these like crazy looking boots. So for his part, and especially, you know, his best event is Pommel Horse. He's also very good on rings. Those are two events that are on your shoulders, can be very, very tough. And so he's tried a lot of things. And this is the one he says that has worked best for him.
It's so interesting because we're so used to the visuals of competition. And suddenly there's mm-hmm. this weird visual if you haven't seen it before. I just wonder, what are people saying about it? Is it controversial at all? Is there any sense that it's distracting or marring?
I don't think that they're concerned about the marks. Vanity is certainly not winning out when it's kind of like whatever I can do to feel healthy. I have had a doctor email me and say, this is not as helpful as you think. And, you know, medically, he had some questions about it. But what I would point to is if you're an athlete, even if it had no physical impact, but somehow it helped your mentality about your sport, then I think they would argue that it still has value.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Do you know if it's painful?
They say it's not. You know, I asked, and if you watch videos of it on YouTube, and I mean, when they put the cup on, it looks uncomfortable. I mean, that's when it looks like a welt, is when it's actually in the cup. But they say, you know, just a little pinch, and then, you know, it's kind of a release. So, no, they say it's not painful.
So interesting. Whatever it takes, I guess.
Yeah.
Rachel Axon is Olympics reporter for USA Today in Rio. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The United States today condemned an attack in Pakistan that killed at least 70 people and wounded many others. It was a suicide bomb blast at a hospital in Quetta, a city in the region of Balochistan, which borders Afghanistan. Many of the dead were lawyers who had gathered at the hospital to mourn a prominent colleague who'd been shot dead earlier today. My BBC colleague, Shaima Khalil, is in Islamabad. She says this wasn't the first time lawyers were singled out by extremists in that part of Pakistan.
Lawyers have been targeted in recent weeks in Quetta, actually, Jeb, and these killings were condemned by Bilal Qasi, the man who was killed himself today. He was a very prominent lawyer. We don't have an exact motive, really, behind gunning him down. We didn't have an exact motive about why the other lawyers were killed. All we know is that lawyers have been a target, and of course, a tragic, tragic turn of events, really, for colleagues who've gone to the hospital to take the body of Bilal Anwar Qasi, who was killed earlier today, only to be victims of a huge blast themselves.
What do you know about the explosion itself?
Well, we did hear from the bomb disposal squad in Quetta, who said at least 16 pounds of explosives were used in this attack. Police are suspecting that this to be a suicide bombing. All throughout the day, really, we've seen scenes of utter chaos and devastation. Bodies strewn across the hospital grounds, people who are severely injured, very obviously still in shock, being helped by emergency services who've rushed into the scene, the police cordoning off the area, trying to find out exactly how a sensitive place and a vulnerable place, really, like the hospital, was hit at such a scale.
Now, Shaima, Balochistan is a fairly troubled part of the country. We know that. It's the mountainous region that borders Afghanistan. Give us some of the context here.
Well, it's a really troubled background against which all of this is playing out today. Balochistan and Quetta are no strangers to attacks. As you mentioned, it borders Afghanistan, it borders Iran. We've got Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, Taliban-affiliated groups. We've got the decades-long separatist insurgency movement that have been calling for independence. So quite a troubled region there. We've heard claims and counterclaims about responsibility for this attack. We've heard recently from a Taliban-affiliated group by the name of Jamaat al-Ahrar, who said that they were responsible for this attack. But earlier we heard from the Balochistan chief minister, who blames the regional rival India for the blast. And this is something that we hear time and time again when violence hits Balochistan, that officials there blame India, claims, of course, that India denies repeatedly. This is the background to this region. This is the background to the city. Having said all of this, many observers will tell you that this particular attack, the way it was carried out, where it was carried out, and the fact that it targeted this group of lawyers is another level of violence against advocates in particular.
I was going to say, is that a new trend to target a specific profession like lawyers?
Well, of course, details are coming in about the nature of the attack. But if you think about it, if you trace the day and how it unfolded, we know that a lawyer was targeted in a killing. He was gunned down earlier in the day. We know that a group of lawyers took that body to the hospital. And after that, they themselves were victims of that blast. They themselves were hit by a huge explosion. Many of them died. Many of them are injured. And this is what the police are trying to find out. Criticisms, of course, by many people, especially lawyers' associations, saying, well, how is it that in a city that has been no stranger to attacks like Quetta, where there's heavy security presence, heavy army presence, was this attack still able to happen at such a scale?
Any response to those questions yet?
Well, not yet, really. All you get is condemnation of the attack. We understand that the prime minister is now in Quetta. He condemned the attack and he said that no one will be allowed to disrupt the peace. But really what we're getting now is more questions than answers to the details of how this exactly happened.
My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil from Islamabad, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Before we go to the break, here's a preview of a story you'll hear tomorrow on The World.
Diamonds are forever.
A Silicon Valley startup is making synthetic diamonds, perfect gems, grown in the lab in about 2 weeks.
This is our unit foundry. It's the prototype foundry for the future. It includes our growth reactors in which we hot forge diamond under the heat of a plasma.
Experts say they're as perfect as the ones mined in Africa. And unlike with so-called blood diamonds, no people are harmed. Or are they?
So the solution isn't to say, you 1.5 million diggers and the 7 million people you're supporting, all of you go to hell, we're going to sell synthetic diamonds.
A new chapter in the blood diamond debate, that's tomorrow. Cybersecurity breaches can have far-reaching consequences. Just ask the Democratic National Committee about all those embarrassing emails that were hacked from its servers and turned over to WikiLeaks. Or ask the 15 million people in Iran who use a messaging app called Telegram. Their information was hacked last week. That was big news because Telegram provides users with end-to-end encryption, but that didn't stop the attack last week.
The attackers were able to learn about all of the people who are using Telegram in Iran.
Eyal Sela is an analyst at a cybersecurity and intelligence company in Israel called Clear Sky. He co-authored a report about a hacking group based in Iran called Rocket Kitten. That's the group allegedly responsible for the Telegram app breach. Sela says the breach affected a huge number of users, but it could have been worse.
The only thing that they have about 15 million users in Iran is their name and identification numbers in the application. They do not have any access to their contact people or to the messages themselves, only to the fact that these people are using the application, which is not a good thing, but it's not as bad as having full access.
But Sela says there was a second smaller part to the attack, which was more concerning. The hackers were able to use stolen verification text messages to break into more than a dozen individual Telegram accounts. That gave the attackers access to all the information in those accounts. The victims are thought to have included scientists, journalists, and activists, the sort of people the Iranian government has been known to spy on. And Sela says the hackers at Rocket Kitten have been connected to that sort of spying in the past.
This group, we know it has been operating for several years now, and it has been attacking hundreds of people throughout the Middle East, the U.S. and Europe, in order to mostly collect information. So they would either breach people's email accounts or they would breach their computer with the malware, and then they would spy on these people. On the people they communicate with, they would steal information and anything that they would be interested in that they have access to, again, in their email or on their computer.
That was Eyal Sela, a cybersecurity analyst at Clear Sky in Israel, speaking there about the Iran-based hacker group known as Rocket Kitten. And finally today. You're hearing the voice of Nima Samimi. He's an Iranian-American singer and songwriter. And that song, Oh Satan, he says it's sort of a love song for the Iranian and American governments and an ode to the Iranian-American identity crisis.
So I'm an American-born, mixed-heritage Iranian-American. My mother's French-Canadian, my father's Iranian. And in many ways, this has been the central question of my life. What is my relationship to Iran, to being Iranian, to my Iranian heritage? Because while on the one hand, I'm very much 100% an American, I'm also very much 100% an Iranian, but I didn't grow up in an Iranian community. I didn't grow up with my Iranian parent. But I have an Iranian name, both my first name and last name, and I've noticed over the course of my life what a difference that makes in one, being able to hold on to one's cultural heritage, that everybody identifies you that way, whether you like it or not, but also the sort of the downside is the othering that comes with it.
And here you are doing this music you categorize as Americana, and yet you would be the first to say it has Persian influence.
That's right. This is one of the central contradictions to my music and my life that, you know, I became a musician at a young age. At 14, I started playing guitar and writing songs. And the question I asked myself was, what kind of music does an Iranian-American make? There were no other Iranian-Americans I knew of making music. And, you know, I was steeped in roots and blues and folk, mostly of the 60s and 70s. And early hip-hop. And it took a lot of years to know myself well enough to believe that I could know myself musically that well. And I think this album is a product of that self-exploration.
Mohammed Seven.
Yes. So this is an alter ego that on tour about 5 years ago, my tour partner, Chris Sand, who's a Montana and North Dakota artist, he and I came up with the name as for a couple of reasons. One, as an opportunity to write for a character. It gives me a little bit more room than just writing for myself. I can talk about the truth as sort of big T truth as opposed to little T truth, things that are true at their core but not necessarily true in my life. And I enjoy having that opportunity as an artist.
I want the swampers in fame, but I settle for that laptop boy. Caught in a hurricane, almost everything's background noise. At night I ride the rails, but I wake up tired to the track.
So the Persian music. Do you listen to Persian music? Did your father, how much did that influence you?
So truth be told, I don't in my daily life listen to lots of Persian music, although I do love Persian music. My father growing up listened to a lot of Persian music, although I wasn't raised by him. I didn't live with him full time. But particularly the pop LA Persian music sound permeated his household. And, you know, he would listen on cassette Walkman. And I loved that. And as a small child, he would sing me Persian pop songs translated as lullabies, like a song called Maro Bebus, which is famous to Iranians. But I think more prominently, Iranian poetry. You know, Iranians are very famous for poetry, and that has been the more major influence. The Sufi poets, my father himself was an avid poet, and at a young age could hear a poem once and recite it backwards from memory.
Wow. I wouldn't normally ask you about politics, but there is this sort of subtle undercurrent of politics in your stage name, in your song, Oh Satan, in who you are. We can't really avoid the U.S.-Iran clash, embrace, and it's election season. Who are you in all that?
It makes me so happy that you would say that, because I'm a very political person and want for my music to be political, but struggle as an artist to be very careful to not preach politically in my music. So anyway, that's exactly what I'm shooting for. So thank you for saying so. Yeah, these things all matter to me so much. You know, the backdrop of my life has very much been the international relations between the United States and Iran. And
your music will solve it all. Nima Samimi, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Jeb.
Iranian-American singer and songwriter Nima Samimi, a.k.a. Muhammad Seven, will leave you with another of his songs. This one's called Saffron Stew. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Jeb Sharp. Thanks for being with us.
Fishbone fry, double your cake, saffron stew, honey pie babe, hometown hickory, walking on a rickety bridge on a river.
PRI, Public Radio International.